nefarious plot afoot. It was Bobby Ray.
Yeah, he said. Yeah, I guess it could have been that. You want to have a look?
That'd be great.
Come on in,
he said, backing away from the door. I took a few tentative steps inside. All the shades were drawn. There were no lights on. The small kitchen table was covered with the detritus of a slovenly bachelor life. A pizza box, the remainder of a TV dinner, a pile of junk mail, crushed beer cans.
Sorry about the mess, Bobby Ray said. Maid's off this week.
No problem, I said, though it only fed my unease.
It was this dingy little trailer. Her dress was ripped, and he had all those guns. What was she, too stupid to live?
I followed Bobby Ray through a small sitting area into his bedroom, where the shades were drawn. I thought maybe I'd see a gun rack or a shotgun on a wall or some sign of his enthusiasm for weaponry, but there was nothing visible. He sat down heavily in front of his computer. My discomfort was only amplified when I saw his screensaver was a naked woman with a come-hither look on her face. In case the gentleman's imagination needed more prodding, her legs were spread wide and she was squeezing her voluptuous breasts between her arms.
She should have run out the moment she saw that porn. She was practically begging for it.
Sorry about that. That's my girlfriend right there,
he joked, swiping at his mouse until the screen went away. You might want to buy her some clothes, I said, trying to be jocular about the whole thing. He had already moved on.
All right, so I set this up myself. It all gets saved to the hard drive, and it stays there for 2 months before it gets wiped out. Any deputy who tries to plant something in here is going to wind up on candid camera, you know what I'm saying?
Bobby Ray brought up a program that showed a split screen of 6 different camera views and continued his narration.
I got 2 inside, 4 outside, and, oh yeah, this one gets some of your driveway.
He centered the mouse over one of the camera views and clicked on it, enlarging it so it filled the entire screen. I was now looking at a real-time view of his side yard, which included my driveway in the top portion.
Yep, he said. Camera 3. Hang on.
He clicked off the live feed and was soon opening a folder where the archived footage must have been stored. Over the next 20 minutes, we rewound through Thursday, Wednesday, then Tuesday, the day of the sheriff's office raid. Then we kept going backward. There was nothing suspicious the remainder of the day on Tuesday. It was just Ben leaving for school and me leaving for work that morning. I felt a little hitch in my breathing as I saw my car. Those would have been among the last moments I got to be with Alex before dropping him off at Mrs. Ferncliff's. Little did I know how much I should have savored that time. Bobby Ray scrolled further back. Monday night was uneventful. Ben returned from JMU, then I came home from Diamond Trucking. Two creatures of habit, acting in their customary ways. Then, at 1:17 p.m. on Monday, there was something that flashed before my eyes, a quick blur that didn't fit the pattern. It was a vehicle of some sort, but it wasn't one we owned.
Wait, wait, stop it there, I said. Can you go back?
Yeah, hang on.
Bobby Ray monkeyed with the footage until he got it to the right spot, then set it at normal speed. The blur had been a van with a decal on the side, backing down my driveway.
What did it say on the side? I asked.
Dunno. Well, let me see if I can get it when it came in.
He kept rolling the footage back until he reached 1:01 p.m., which was when the truck had arrived.
Here we go,
he said.
Let me pause it.
He brought the van back on the screen, then froze it there, allowing me to make out the words. A1 Valley Plumbing. Bonded. Licensed. Free estimates. When you have a drip, we drop everything. 800, Get Valley. It looked like a perfectly legitimate service van, except for one small detail. I hadn't called a plumber. Chapter 16. Amy Kay had been playing this out in her head ever since the idea first occurred to her during that restless time after 2 a.m. It had been rattling around in there during General District Court, through the arraignments, the speeders, and the drunks. It had even been somewhere in her mind when she got the surprise that was seeing Melanie Barrick's name on the docket for a bond hearing relating to assault charges. Now here was the conversation she had been mentally preparing for all day.
All right, Amy, a sheriff's deputy said. We've got Warren Plotz waiting for you in the conference room.
Great, Amy said, already walking away from the detective's bullpen at the Augusta County Sheriff's Office, where she had been bantering with one of the investigators.
Did he give you any trouble?
Not a bit.
We told him it was voluntary and he practically leapt in the car. He seemed pretty excited about it, actually.
Perfect, she said. This was her middle-of-the-night brainstorm. She wasn't about to approach Warren Plotz head-on about the 2-decade string of unsolved sexual assaults in which he was now the primary suspect. There was too great a chance he'd spook and run. But she still wanted to size the guy up, to look him in the eye and see what she was dealing with. Maybe she'd catch him in a lie or two she could use against him later. Maybe she'd even get more than that, if he fell into the trap she had planned for him. And Melanie Barrick, of all people, had given her the perfect excuse to be able to come at him, not head-on, but from the side.
Mr. Plotz, she said as she entered the conference room, thank you so much for coming in. I'm Amy Kay with the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office.
In person, he was the same slightly stocky guy she had seen on Facebook. The douchebag aviator glasses were perched atop his brown hair. He wore the chunky watch on his left wrist. Otherwise, she was seeing how he could have eluded so many women's description. He had no scars, no tattoos, nothing unusual about his size or shape that stood out. It was almost like he went out of his way to be average. She gave him what she felt was a professionally appropriate smile and a firm handshake.
Nice to meet you, he said easily.
Take a seat, any seat, she said casually. She wanted this whole thing to feel as informal as possible. He sat at the end of the table. She sat across from him and placed a blank legal pad in front of her. Then she tilted back in the chair. Again, casual. According to Virginia statute, he didn't need to know about the digital recorder she had just started.
So, I'm sure you've heard about the raid on Melanie Barrick and what was found in her house?
Everyone in the valley's heard, I think, he confirmed.
Right. So, as you've probably already guessed, we're investigating Ms. Barrick's role in what appears to be a major drug distribution conspiracy. At this point, we're trying to get a full picture of her activities. I really appreciate your cooperation.
Sure.
And then Amy coughed. Just once. She wanted to start slow. Anyhow, how long has Ms. Barrick been employed with Diamond Trucking?
It's probably been like 3-4 years now. I'd have to check with my bookkeeper.
Amy jotted this down on the legal pad. What she didn't write down, but certainly noted in her mind, was that he hadn't said the bookkeeper or our bookkeeper. It was my bookkeeper. He was insecure, but trying to make himself seem more important. Just like a power reassurance rapist would.
And what is her position there? She asked.
She's a dispatcher.
So She tells the trucks where to go, where to pick up their next load, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that sort of thing.
That means she has a lot of interaction with all your drivers. She knows all of them? Talks to them all regularly?
Definitely.
Right, Amy said, nodding. Then she added, as if it were an afterthought, Oh, I should also probably ask you, what's your position at the company?
I guess you'd call me vice president.
Amy was sure no one called him anything of the sort. But again, it was worth noting. And how long have you been employed with Diamond?
It's my family's company, so I basically grew up there.
A long time, then, she said.
Yeah.
You've always worked on the administrative side?
Nah, I was on the road for a lot of years. I felt like it'd be good experience to learn the business from the ground up, you know?
Oh, that's smart, Amy said. So when did you shift to the office?
I'd say 2011, 2012, something like that, he said.
Bingo. It was just as Daphne Hasper said. Warren Plotz got off the road right around the time the whispering rapist stepped up the frequency of his attacks. And now she had him saying it on a recording. Amy coughed again. Twice this time. She didn't want to oversell it. Excuse me, she said. Then she resumed. Would you say Ms. Barrick has been a good employee? Punctual? Reliable?
Yeah, I guess.
You guess?
I don't know. I mean, don't get me wrong. She always did the job. She just always acted like she was better than everyone else. Like, you know, she was just lowering herself to work there. My dad, he was all into her because she went to UVA. I guess you could say he had an old man crush on her.
I can understand that, Amy said, trying to sound objective. Then she tossed out some bait to see if he would rise to it. She's a pretty girl, isn't she? Plotz didn't bite.
Not my type. I like them with a little more meat on their bones.
He grinned at her. His eyes darted up and down Amy's body, which was full-figured. She had to suppress a shudder. She should have known he'd be too cagey to indicate he was attracted to one of his victims. He was so relaxed, sitting there in the sheriff's conference room, gabbing easily with the chief deputy Commonwealth's attorney. So your dad liked her, Amy said, but you didn't.
Yeah, to be honest, none of this surprises me. I always thought she was hiding something.
Like what?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it was drugs, obviously.
With that, Amy launched into a coughing fit, this time going at it until she was sure she was a bit red in the face. You know what? I'm sorry. I think I need a soda or something, she said, then tossed in, You want one?
No, I'm good.
Crap. You sure? My treat. Come on, it's not every day I offer to buy a guy a drink, she said, adding a wink. Amy, the woman with a little meat on her bones, couldn't believe she was flirting with a suspected rapist. Anything to get the job done. And it worked.
All right,
he said. What do you want?
They got Sprite?
Sure. I'll be right back. Amy rose from her seat and left the room. She found herself breathing a little hard as she went to the vending machine. This was the part she had been thinking about since the small hours of the morning. And it was working out the way she hoped. She got Sprite for him, Coke Zero for herself. Then she returned to the conference room and slid the can in front of him. Like, you know, no big deal. Then she sat, cracked open her soda, and took a long drink. Ah, she said. That hit the spot. Plotz didn't touch his. Damn. She put her Coke Zero down next to her legal pad, then continued. So you thought Ms. Barrick was hiding something?
Right.
Did she ever attempt to sell you drugs?
No, nothing like that.
Did she ever try to sell drugs to any of your other employees?
Not that I know of, but I'll definitely ask.
Thank you, she said. Now, this next question is, I know it might be a little difficult for you, given that this is a family business. But as you know, an 18-wheeler is a pretty big piece of real estate. There have been many documented cases of truckers using them to smuggle drugs around the country. We're looking into the theory that that's what was happening here. Do you think it's possible Ms. Barrick's supplier is one of your drivers? This actually wasn't a theory at all. She just wanted to make Plotz feel thirsty. He grimaced.
I don't know. Our guys, they're pretty clean. They're family men, for the most part. And a lot of them have been with us for 10, 20, 30 years. They're not the sort to go around doing something like that.
Still, think hard. You have a lot of drivers, do you not?
Yeah.
There's not one that might try to make a little something extra on the side? Maybe someone who didn't come from around here, who might have connections elsewhere, especially in Texas or Florida. A lot of cocaine enters the country in those two places. He stared off at the wall for a moment. Then, finally, Amy got what she was waiting for. He reached for the Sprite, popped the top, and took a long sip. As he took it away from his mouth, Amy could see a small strand of saliva, brimming with DNA, stretching from his lips to the can. Chapter 17. After he loaded the pertinent computer file onto a thumb drive for me, Bobby Ray asked if I wanted to stay for a beer. I politely declined, making noises about how I still needed to tidy up after the deputy's rampage through our house. What I really wanted to do was figure out who was behind A1 Valley Plumbing and what prompted that person to bring poison up my driveway and into my life. He persisted, but my references to government overreach eventually triggered his sympathy. He led me out with assurances that if I required his services again, all I needed to do was ask. I now felt silly for having built Bobby Ray into a menace. Yes, he was a crackpot who shunned basic housekeeping, liked pornography, and kept a large cache of weapons, all choices I wouldn't necessarily condone or make for myself. But he was also a friendly man who was willing to help a neighbor in need. It turned out the basket of deplorables wasn't as irredeemable as some might make it seem. Walking back toward my place, I remembered I was still locked out. It would be a few hours before Ben got home. But this now struck me as an excellent opportunity to simulate the first obstacle that would have faced the A1 Valley plumber after he reached the top of my driveway. How hard was it to break into our house? It had been constructed in the 1950s, a more guileless time when doors and windows were not made as impregnable as they are now. We also didn't have a security system. Still, the front door handle was locked. That was pickable for someone with the right tools, but we also had a deadbolt. I didn't think the A1 Valley plumber could have overcome that without leaving major damage to the door. Then I moved on to the window to the left of the front door and was immediately stunned. It wasn't locked. How was that possible? Had we really been that careless? Or had the mystery plumber jimmied it open and then left it that way in case he felt like coming back? There was no way to tell. I slid it open and climbed into the house, just as anyone else with a mild amount of dexterity could have done. I closed it and locked it behind myself. As much out of frightened curiosity as anything, I then went around to look at all the other windows. They were all locked. But obviously, it only took one. Once I completed my sweep, I sat down on the couch with my aging laptop and plugged A1 Valley Plumbing into Google. The first hit was a plumber out in Ohio, though it had a different name. There was also an A1 Plumbing in California that might or might not still have been in operation. Next, I tried A1 Valley Plumbing Stanton, VA. This led to a variety of pages offering to connect me with plumbing services, most of them weird aggregating sites that were clearly run by algorithms and just missed in their attempts to seem like they had been written by humans. Then I tried Angie's List, and Yelp, and a domain registry search, and the State Corporation Commission. I went with different combinations of words, even different spellings. In every instance, none of what returned to me remotely matched. As far as the combined knowledge of the World Wide Web was concerned, an enterprise known as A1 Valley Plumbing did not do business anywhere, and certainly not within the state of Virginia. It was clearly a fraud, a company that existed on a decal and nowhere else. Confirming my suspicion, I dialed the 800 number listed on the side. I was soon connected to an adult entertainment line. That made it official. To borrow Teddy's phrasing, someone was messing with me. Merely allowing the thought to take root made me feel like I must have been suffering from some paranoid fantasy. I took enough psychology at UVA to know that people with persecution complexes are usually suffering from either schizophrenia or extreme narcissism. And yet, there it was, bizarre but true, as plain as the video I had just seen. Thinking about that footage made me want to watch it again. I plugged Bobby Ray's thumb drive into my laptop and saved the file onto my desktop. I clicked it, and before long the van was driving up my driveway. Then, 16 minutes later, most of which I fast-forwarded through, the van was backing down my driveway. Up, then down. Up, then down. I played it backward and forward. I played it in real time and slow-mo. I freeze-framed it so I could study it more carefully. Bobby Ray's home-cooked system wasn't very high resolution. When I zoomed in on it for a closer look, all I got were big, blobby pixels that quickly became indistinguishable as discrete lines or objects. The angle wasn't helping me either. Bobby Ray hadn't been trying to capture my driveway, just his own side lawn. I couldn't see the top of the van, nor the front, nor the back. So no license plate. And the only look at the driver was a fleeting glimpse from the side. He appeared to be an angular white man with a buzz cut. But he did have one distinguishing feature, a scar running along the side of his head. You couldn't really tell where it started, but once it crossed into his scalp, it stood out as this thin, vivid white line where the hair refused to grow. Who was he? Why had he felt the need to obliterate my life? And how could I find him? Surely a man with a scar that distinctive would be memorable. But what if he wasn't from around here, and had already gone back to wherever he came from? I ran the footage back and forth until I got the best picture of him I could, then grabbed a screenshot and emailed it to Teddy. If this plumber was someone involved in the drug world, and he had to be if he had access to a half kilo of cocaine, right? Then there was a chance Teddy, with his checkered youth, might have bumped across the guy. Who knows? If he turned out to be a real lowlife, maybe my deficient lawyer, Mr. Honeysickle, or whatever his name was, would actually start trying to defend me. "Do you know this man?" I wrote in my message to Teddy. I think this is who broke into my house and planted the drugs there. I watched the video a few more times until I decided I had seen it enough to know I hadn't missed anything. I needed to get a grip on myself. I also, after 3 long days of accumulating sweat and grime, needed a shower. Like a lot of people, I think well in the shower. There's something about it. The soothing feeling of water striking skin, the warm haze of the air, the ritual of cleansing, that helps eliminate the noise of the world to focus instead on the signals that are trying to break through. It was in that calming environment that I again asked myself the question, why? Why had this nefarious, scar-headed faux plumber come up my driveway? What was so important or significant about me that made me worth this much effort? I was stumped. I wasn't a threat to anyone. Framing me as a drug dealer and getting me tossed in jail didn't make anyone's life better. Who needed me out of the picture that badly? What did I have that was even worth taking? The shower poured down on me. The lather carried the dirt away. The steam did its work, taking away some of the wrinkles of the world. And then the answer crushed me. Alex. The people messing with me were trying to get my baby removed from me. They had already succeeded, temporarily. And they were going to persist until they made it permanent. It was starting to make sense. Alex was the only valuable I could claim as my own. And as a healthy white male baby, he clearly had tremendous value to someone else, too. What was he worth? $20,000? $40,000? $100,000? Had there been an auction? Whatever the amount, I'm sure there was enough money involved that whoever was doing this could bribe social services. Or perhaps they had found another way to control the system. The how of it only mattered so much now that I understood the why. I had thought of myself as the target in this attack, and Alex as the collateral damage. What if it was the other way around? What if taking Alex was the prime objective all along? And what if I was just the woman in the way? Chapter 18. I barely recalled getting myself under the covers that night. I also didn't stir when Ben got home and climbed into bed. My sleep was deep and unbroken, which was in itself a novel phenomenon. Between pregnancy and nursing, I hadn't experienced a solid night's sleep since sometime in my second trimester. At morning light, I was still groggy. My first thought came to me when I was still in half-dreaming mode, before my central processor really kicked in. And it was a panic. I had slept too hard, straight through Alex's cries. He must have been starving by now. I bolted upright. Then I remembered reality, which hit me with a sharp stab to the heart. For a moment or two, I laid back down. But there was no getting back to sleep. I looked over at Ben, curled on his side, still in slumber. Wanting to feel closer to Alex, I rolled out of bed and padded softly into the nursery. It was exactly as I had left it 2 mornings earlier, when I had hastily straightened it. The hole in the ceiling remained. I had yet to put the air conditioning exchange cover back into place. I picked up Mr. Snuggs from the changing table, just to have something to hold. Then I wandered over to where Alex should have been, and stared down at the sheet cover, which was stretched out drum tight and snapped down to prevent suffocation. There was a thin dusting of baby powder on the cover. I hadn't noticed it before, though Ben was sometimes a little more liberal with the powder than I was. A blanket was laid out, waiting to swaddle a child who wasn't there. What I should have been doing right then was bending down, scooping Alex up, unbundling him so he could move his little arms around, then taking him over to the chair where I nursed him. He was always so snuggly and soft and warm first thing in the morning. His absence made me feel all that much colder by comparison. What sprang into my mind was the famous six-word memoir usually attributed to Hemingway. For sale. Baby shoes. Never worn. Mine probably would have read something like, "My morning. Throbbing breasts. Empty crib." I used my hand pump, then sat down on the carpet that filled the middle of the room. After a feeding, I often plopped Alex down on his stomach so he could have some tummy time. He had this mat with a flexible plastic mirror built into it. He loved staring at himself and slobbering on it while he struggled to lift his head, which was so big compared to the rest of him. I always cheered him on. So what was I supposed to do with myself now? Alex's arrival had not only given me purpose, it had filled every crevice of my days and nights. When I wasn't at work or asleep, I was with him. What did I do with my time before Alex? I stared dumbly at the wall, waiting to get some idea. Nothing came to me. Somewhere in the midst of this pathetic reverie, Ben entered the doorframe. The first thing I saw was his dark, skinny legs jutting out from his boxer shorts. My eyes worked up from there to his face, which looked puffy behind his glasses. "Good morning," he said. "Hey," I replied. "What are you doing?" "I don't know," I said quite honestly. My voice sounded hollow to me. "You want some company?" "Sure," I said. He entered the room and sat down next to me, close but not quite touching. "You were out cold when I came home last night," he said. "Yeah, I just passed out." He accepted this without comment. "I tried to call you yesterday, a couple of times." "I still don't know where my phone is." "We should really just get you a new one," he said. "You've got to be eligible for an upgrade by now. You haven't gotten one in a while. They have a bunch you can get for free if you sign up for a new contract. I'll stop by the wireless store today and see if I can do that for you if you want." I craned my neck and stared at him for a moment. With everything going on, it struck me as preposterous my brilliant, perceptive, empathetic husband was talking to me about cell phone plans. "Whatever," I said, and returned to staring at the wall. Then, without looking at him, I asked what I really wanted to know. "Where were you yesterday?" It came out as an accusation as much as it did a question. "Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I couldn't find anyone to take my section. You know what Kramer is like if someone tries to cancel anything. Teddy convinced me he could handle it. He said they'd probably just give you a court date and let you go. He said it was really no big deal. I figured he'd know better than I would." And I figured my husband would want to be there.
How did it go, anyway?
He asked. It turns out assaulting an officer is a felony, punishable by up to 5 years in prison.
Oh, my God. You didn't even mean to hit him.
I don't think that's considered a defense.
But what are you going to do?
Maybe my English background made me too sensitive to pronouns, but I was annoyed by his use of the second person singular. An ugly thought sprang from my head. If I was the mother of his biological child, would he have used the first person plural? Would he have showed up in court yesterday? The trial is scheduled for May 18th. They assigned me a lawyer, Mr. Honey's something or other.
Is he any good?
I can't say I've been terribly impressed so far. Ben adjusted his glasses.
I talked to Teddy for a while yesterday, he said. I really don't think those drugs were his.
Me neither.
So, I'm sure you've been thinking about this too, but a half a kilo of cocaine doesn't just magically show up in your house.
I know.
Where did it come from?
I just shook my head.
Do you think there's a way we could, I don't know, track it back to the source? He asked. Maybe if we can find who the original dealer was, we can figure out who bought it, and therefore who planted it?
How would we do that?
I don't know, he admitted. But whenever you're trying to understand something historically, you usually have to go all the way back to the beginning. It seems to me the same concept applies here.
We sat in silence, still not touching.
And what's the deal with the drugs charges? He asked. It seems weird you haven't heard from anyone about that.
The prosecutor mentioned something about indicting me, but...
Yeah, but don't they have to arrest you first? Or charge you? Or something?
I don't know, I snapped. I knew Ben was just trying to be helpful, but his questions were irritating me. I didn't feel like rehashing any of this with him. Whether I had to beat the drug charges first or the assault charges first, the fact remained I couldn't convince social services I was a fit mother from the wrong side of a jail cell. I needed a legal strategy. And neither Ben nor Mr. Honey Whatever was going to help me with that. I had to find a real lawyer. I wondered if I could eke out the money to afford one who wasn't appointed by the court. Could I talk to the bank about reducing our mortgage payments for a few months? Could we sell the house I loved in the hopes our small improvements would allow us to make some money on it? Ben finally tuned into the testy edge to my voice because he placed his hand over mine.
I'm sorry I wasn't there yesterday, okay? That was obviously a mistake. I shouldn't have listened to Teddy and... That's not even the point. It's not Teddy's fault. It's my fault. I should have been there. And I want to help, okay? Don't freeze me out here.
I stood up. I have to get ready for work. Can we just talk about it later?
Yeah, sure.
What's your schedule like today?
Same as usual. I was going to do some dissertation stuff in the morning. I have a section this afternoon. Then I'm tutoring till 8.
Okay, I said. I guess I'll see you at home after that. He was still sitting on the floor when I left the room. Chapter 19. My morning routine, which usually involved spending 90% of my time getting Alex ready and about 10% on myself, was now significantly streamlined, as was my commute. There was no trip out to Mrs. Verncliffe's to worry about. I was 15 minutes early when I pulled into the parking lot of Diamond Trucking, which was fine. I was actually eager to get to work. At the moment, 8 hours of playing 18-wheel Sudoku
which was dispatching at its essence, sounded like a vacation. Once inside, I was greeted warmly by the guy who pulled the graveyard shift, a former trucker everyone called Willie because he looked like Willie Nelson. Willie was just finishing up his rundown on everything I needed to know when the front door opened. A nervous-looking woman in a teal sweater set, gripping a matching purse, peered around the door for a tentative moment, then entered.
"Hi, I'm Amanda. I'm here for the training,"
she said in a squeaky voice that had the habit of turning up at the end of every sentence. Willie and I swapped empty looks. "Training for what?" I asked.
The logistics manager job?" she said, now even more uncertain.
"Oh," I said. "Then, yes, I guess you're in the right place. I'm Melanie. This is Willie." In the past 4 years, I had trained several dispatchers, including Willie. Normally, I got an email saying I should expect a new trainee coming in. But I would forgive the lapse if it meant I was preparing Amanda to replace deadbeat Warren Plotz on the swing shift.
"On the phone, I spoke to a Warren," Amanda said.
Warren? Since when did Warren hire dispatchers? "Warren is the owner's son," I said. "He's not, well, whatever. First thing you're going to need is a headset. You'll be spending your whole shift on the phone, and you'll need your hands free to type. Let me see if there's a fresh one in the supply closet. We sort of have a rule among dispatchers that you don't use someone else's headset."
"Yep," Willie chimed in. "Believe me, you don't want mine. I spend my whole shift spitting on it."
"Welcome to Diamond Trucking, Amanda." I went into the supply closet in the next room and rooted around in it until I found a headset. When I returned, I felt a scowl reflexively spreading across my face. Warren Plotz had just walked in. He was wearing his $250 aviator sunglasses, the ones he thought made him look like Justin Timberlake and I thought made him look like a jerk.
"What are you doing here?" he demanded.
My job. Why?
Shouldn't you be in jail or something?"
I felt my face flush. Amanda's eyes widened. She clutched her purse a little tighter. "No," I said. "I got bailed out."
"Well, we don't need you here anymore."
"What are you talking about?"
"You've been fired."
The earth shifted a little under my feet.
"What?"
I demanded.
"Fired? As in not working here anymore? This girl here is your replacement. You can just get along now. I'll have your last check mailed to you."
Trying to stay calm, I placed the headset box on the table next to the phone. Warren's animosity for me dated back to an incident that happened in the office maybe a week or two after I started working there. He made a clumsy pass at me, and I firmly swatted it away. Maybe too firmly. He had been looking for a chance to get his revenge ever since. I narrowed my eyes at him. "I have been a dedicated employee of Diamond Trucking for 4 years now. You have absolutely no cause to fire me."
"Yeah, I do. You didn't show up for work yesterday."
"You don't show up for work all the time," I burst out. "And unlike you, I actually called to say I wasn't going to be here so I didn't leave anyone hanging."
"Yeah, that doesn't matter now. I had the sheriff's office come to my house yesterday, asking about you. I ended up going down to headquarters. They told me all about you. They were saying you might have been getting your drugs from one of our drivers. Next thing you know, they're going to be sniffing around here, wanting to talk to everyone. I can't have that."
"Those drugs weren't mine," I said fiercely.
"Sure they weren't. Look, this is my family's business. We got a reputation to uphold. I can't have people at church going around thinking we employ drug dealers."
"Would you stop? For the love of God, Warren, you've known me for 4 years. You really, seriously, think I'm a drug dealer?
I think the sheriff's office pulled a whole bunch of coke out of your house and they say you've been dealing. That's good enough for me.
This is absurd, I said. This is just an accusation at this point. I'm innocent until proven guilty. And besides, you can't fire me. I don't work for you. I work for your father.
At this point, Warren got a wicked grin on his face.
Oh, yeah? You think I didn't talk to him about this? Go ahead. Call him if you want to. He'll tell you the same thing.
This stopped me cold. I could handle Warren Plotz being as nasty to me as he wanted to be. His father was supposed to be different. He had been unfailingly kind. A man who always looked out for me. A man I thought cared for me as more than just an employee. To have him assuming the worst about me, thinking I could have possibly done what I was accused of, and essentially giving up on me, was crushing.
Oh, I choked out.
That's right. So you just get along now, Warren said, sneering at me, knowing he already had me beaten.
Virginia employment law was a joke. A private employer like this one could fire you for virtually any reason, or no reason at all. There was no fighting this. I had too many other fights on my hands already. I had to get out of there. Any moment, I was going to cry. Warren was enjoying my distress too much already. I stumbled into the women's bathroom, where I stored my breast pumps, and grabbed both of them. Then I went back out into the office and looked around to see if there was anything I needed to take with me. There wasn't. I had poured 4 years of my life into diamond trucking. But I would be leaving it without a trace. Not knowing what else to do, I drove home. My hope was that Ben would still be there when I arrived. For as bitchy and standoffish as I had been to him earlier in the morning, I was now aching to collapse into his arms. But he had already left. The house was empty. Way too empty. I couldn't stay there. That home had been meant for a family, not a morose, childless, jobless woman. Sparing myself any internal debate about whether I should bother him, I got back in my car and pointed it north, toward Harrisonburg, and James Madison University, and Ben. Selfish as it may have been, I was on the brink of a breakdown. I needed my husband. As I drove, I tried not to think about the implications of what had just happened to me. But it was impossible. I felt like the little Dutch boy trying to stick my finger in the dike and hold back the sea. The problem was, I had more leaks than fingers. The deluge was coming. What was I going to do without an income? My $18 an hour might not have been princely compared to what some of my UVA classmates were now pulling in, but I was still our primary breadwinner by a large margin. I needed to find another job, and quickly. There were other trucking companies in the area, but they'd all want to know why I left my old job. Diamond Trucking was known to have the best benefits package in the area. Most people left other companies to go to it, not the other way around. There would be no hiding that I had been fired. Who was I kidding? There would be no hiding anything about my circumstances. If the entire Shenandoah Valley didn't know about me already, one quick Google search of my name would bring up media reports where I had been christened Coke Mom. Who would hire me with felony charges hanging over my head? Even my fallback, or what used to be my fallback, was gone. Marcus had left Starbucks 2 years ago and was now working at some kind of benefits management company. It was pure catastrophe.
We had no financial cushion. We had spent most of it on the down payment for the house, and the rest of it on whatever small renovations we could afford. My checking account currently had about $900 in it. My savings account had $50, the minimum amount needed to keep it open. Ben might have had a little more. He and I still had separate accounts. Everything leading up to Alex's arrival had happened so quickly. My rape, my pregnancy, our shotgun wedding, buying the house, having the baby. Consolidating our finances had not been a priority. But he also might have had even less. We certainly didn't have any kind of investments we could liquidate, nor did we have any true valuables to sell, other than maybe Ben's vinyl record collection. That would buy us, what, a few weeks' worth of groceries? Maybe a mortgage payment? There wasn't even anyone we could appeal to for help. Ben's father was a high school janitor. His mother worked at a grocery store. They didn't have anything to loan us. They were counting the minutes until they could collect Social Security and get a little breathing room. And my parents? Ah. I couldn't imagine what kind of sad shape they were in by now. If they were even still alive. It wasn't hard to imagine one of them killing the other, or themselves. We were on our own in every way. One thing was for sure. There was now no chance of being able to shuffle around our finances to pay for a private lawyer. We'd be lucky if we could keep the house. Then there was our family's health insurance, which I had also just lost. Diamond Trucking would have to offer me Cobra coverage, but I doubted we could afford it. Or there was the biggest issue of all. How would I convince a judge to give me Alex back, when I might not even be able to provide for his basic needs? I suddenly understood what it was like to live in one of those war-torn countries salted with landmines. Everywhere I even thought about stepping, there was something blowing up on me. By the time I reached the JMU campus, I was desperate to find Ben. I was glad he didn't have a class. It meant I would have him to myself for a little while. I would have called to find out where he was, but I still didn't have a phone. Maybe Ben was right to focus on that this morning after all. I was tired of being in the dark ages of communications. No matter, I would just have to find him the old-fashioned way. I parked and headed into the library, where he had a small study carrel assigned to him. Except he wasn't there. The tiny room was dark and locked. I knocked just in case. No Ben. The only other place he could have been was the history department. He and the other PhD candidates had desks in a windowless interior room they referred to as the broom closet. The history department was on the second floor of Jackson Hall, just across the quad from the library. I walked as quickly as I could, passing knots of oblivious undergraduates, all of them blissful in their little college cocoon. I took the stairs, passing through the department's small reception area, then down a long hallway of professors' offices, one of which would hopefully belong to my husband someday. When I reached the broom closet, I was disappointed again. Still no Ben. The small desks were crowded with books and papers, as they always were, but there were no people sitting at them. I reversed track to the reception area, where there was an older woman, sitting by herself, staring at her computer screen. The department secretary, I presumed. "Excuse me," I said, and she looked up from the screen. "I'm trying to find Ben Barrick. Have you seen him?" Her head tilted. "Ben Barrick?" The woman must have been new. "He's a grad student. He has a desk just down the hall." "I know who you're talking about," she said, "but he's not here. Ben's not with the program anymore." I shook my head, refusing to believe the words I was hearing. "Are you sure we're talking about the same person? My Ben Barrick is about 5'9", glasses,
dark skin. He's TAing a class for Professor Kramer this semester.
Yes, that's the same Ben Barrick, she said. And I can assure you he's not TAing anything for Professor Kramer. Professor Kramer left last spring. He's at Temple University in Philadelphia now. Didn't you hear?
Chapter 20. There were two ways Amy Kay could go about handling the Sprite can that was, she hoped, teeming with Warren Plotz's genetic material. She could do it the conventional way, which was to slip it in a padded evidence envelope and mail it to the Virginia Department of Forensic Sciences Western Laboratory, a state-run facility located in Roanoke. There, it would be placed in line behind the enormous mountain of evidence that came in from all over the western half of Virginia. Murder cases got priority. Everything else was handled in the order it was received. The average wait time, according to the Department of Forensic Sciences' most recent report, was 156 days. Or she could do it the unconventional way, which involved driving and begging. She opted for the drive. With the Sprite can sealed in an evidence bag next to her on the front seat, she got on Interstate 81. Then she began tracing her way south through the Blue Ridge Mountains, enjoying the scenery as she fought past slow-moving trucks. She was about halfway there, just south of Lexington, when her phone rang. She practically groaned when she saw the caller was Aaron Dansby.
Amy Kay.
Amy, it's Aaron.
Hey, where are you?
The Commonwealth's attorneys seldom expressed interest in where she was or what she was doing at a given moment. It was one of the nice things about working for Aaron Dansby. He wasn't the type of boss who breathed down anyone's neck, mostly because he couldn't be bothered, but whatever. When she wasn't in court, Amy set her own schedule, free from his harassment.
I'm driving some evidence down to Roanoke. Why?
I thought you were presenting Coke Mom to the grand jury today.
I am, she said.
Okay. I want to do it with you.
Amy's face formed a question mark.
I'm not sure I understand.
No offense, but I think it would make a real impression on the grand jury if they get to see the Commonwealth's attorney, the guy they actually elected, and not the chief deputy. I'll talk to them a little, give them a rah-rah speech, let them know how important this case is. Then you can take it from there.
Amy wished she had a recording of this to play for the next meeting of the Commonwealth's Attorney's Executive Conference. No one would believe it otherwise.
Aaron, she said carefully, slowly, the grand jury meets in secret.
Yeah, I know.
It's secret from us, too.
For a moment, Amy heard nothing but dead air on the line. More than 3 years into his 4-year term, Aaron Dansby still didn't know how some of the basics worked.
Oh, he said at last. They get to ask questions of the investigator or whatever other witnesses they want to hear from, but it's actually illegal for us to be in there with them, unless we're appearing as witnesses or they tell the clerk they need advice on a legal question.
Oh,
he said again. Because she was actually enjoying herself, she added, if you or I even stepped foot in the room and spoke to them without being invited, it would invalidate whatever indictment we were seeking.
Right. Got it, Dansby said. I'll let you know when the clerk has issued a capias. I know you're an eager beaver on this one.
That's good, then. Thank you, he said, suddenly using his politician voice,
the one that was a little more commanding and a little more fake than his normal voice, which was already pretty fake.
I look forward to hearing about the capias. I'd like to leak this.
Then, amazingly, he actually corrected himself.
I'd like to